Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You don't think that it's time that somebody cared enough to have a dream?
Why are you getting so upset? This is not about you.
Yes, it is. You are a human affront to all women, and I am a woman.
At some point, you gotta decide for yourself who you are. Can't let nobody make that decision for you.
How do you go about getting an exorcism?
I beg your pardon?
Hi, this is Mark Kermode. Thanks for downloading this Kermode on Film podcast. This week's edition comes live from the BFI South Bank in London, where every month I do my MK3D live show. Coming up, you'll be hearing from Anna Meredith, who composed the brilliant music for Bo Burnham's debut feature, Eighth Grade, which is currently playing in UK cinemas. We'll be meeting the makers of King Cohen, a documentary about cult filmmaker Larry Cohen. And I'll be talking to Benedikt Erlingsson, the director of Woman at War, a brilliant Icelandic black comedy. But let's start with Beat, a drama about rave culture set in 1994. The film is directed by Brian Welsh, who we'll meet in a moment. Just a quick warning, there is some strong language.
Hello, Colin. It's about Jono. He won't be coming in today. He's dead. Aye, we're all pure gutted, like. I'll pass that on.
They want us to get in line, but we won't. They want us to be afraid of each other, but we're not.
That boy's dragged you down.
Just you try and stop us all.
Where lawlessness prevails, people become a danger to themselves.
He's a really proper best pals, eh?
We are!
I'll see you on the other side then.
It's getting great reviews. It opens here in 2 weeks. Please welcome to the stage the director of Beat, Brian Welsh.
So, Brian, I saw the film on my own in a screening room. I wanted to be seeing it with a crowd of people. And I am not of an age in which rave culture was a thing.
Okay.
But even I understood it. The story was told well enough that even I went, I'm starting to understand this. What was it that drew you to that story? Was it the political side to it or the music side to it? What was the way in for you?
I mean, I think it was all of those things, but... certainly, so it's based on a play, and what was quite interesting to me coming out from watching the play was that there were people from all different ages. It didn't matter whether they'd grown up in the 60s or the 70s or the 80s or the 90s. They all responded to it, despite the fact it was about rave culture and everything that went along with that. And I think all of us can identify with that moment when our mind is opened by music and disobedience.
There's a thread running all the way through it, which is the Criminal Justice and Public Order Act of 1994, which has this strange thing written into the rubric about it, which is in the trailer, which is the specific banning of any festival with
music characterised wholly or predominantly by the emission of a succession of repetitive beats.
I mean, the craziness of that phrase sort of tells you something about the times. But it's about trying to suppress something which you can't suppress with that kind of law. It's about a grassroots movement, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's about, you know, people gathering in fields to dance around tribal music and in a big collective. And it's something that we've been doing for thousands of years, and but in the 90s, there was so much kind of fear and moral panic around what was happening with, you know, in places like Castle Morton, where there was like 80,000 people showed up, and Middle England was obviously very, very afraid, and So the Criminal Justice Bill was this piece of legislation that was written both to kind of clamp down on rave parties, but also other forms of dissent.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the most remarkable thing from my point of view is the reason I know about the Criminal Justice Bill and the Criminal Justice Act was that written into the tiny small print of it was an amendment to the Video Recordings Act, which meant that if you were a horror fan, which I was, it suddenly outlawed a whole bunch of extreme cinema titles. So it was, I mean, I've always thought there was a connection between the way in which horror fans were sort of, you know, sidelined by the law and dance music was sidelined, and the way nowadays people who are interested in computer games, that same kind of demonization.
I mean, it was an attack on all kinds of, like, outsiders, you know, traveling communities, and the same piece of legislation was then used to, you know, stop busloads of people who were going down to protest against the war in Iraq. And then, you know, this week we're seeing that legislation used against the Extinction Rebellion in London. And also it was the first time that legally someone exercising their right to remain silent could be inferred as an indication of guilt.
Yeah. All very important issues. Obviously the suppression of horror movies is the very top of that list. So there is a sequence in the film in which you take us inside someone who is experiencing the rave, and the film is in black and white, but I don't know how much you want. Do you want to say something about that sequence?
It's pretty much out now. I don't really think we can keep the lid on it, to be honest.
So tell us about it, because I thought it was a really powerful sequence, and it reminded me, weirdly enough, of Ken Russell's Altered States, which is one of my favourite films.
Absolutely, we watched that a lot. I mean, that was a big reference for us. Yeah, and well spotted.
I got that right, you see? He said I got it right.
Nikki, the video artist who I worked with closely to produce that, it's like a psychedelic sequence in the middle of the film. Altered States was one of our key references, as was some of like the early Shaman videos, or you know, like the scratch 16mm. Stuff that would be used like in music videos like Voodoo Ray, and this kind of all combined, a bit of 2001 Space Odyssey in there as well. And yeah.
So how old are you?
I am 38. I had to think about that.
So you're not old enough to have gone through this yourself?
Well, I kind of caught I started going out a bit after 94, but a lot of the guys, 94 was the year that the Criminal Justice Bill was passed, but a lot of the guys who we used to run about with in Scotland were that generation before, so they were still, you know, put carrying the torch and sort of putting on nights and beaches in Balmeddy and Aberdeen that were so kind of remote that no one would ever know that they were going on.
I've done gigs like that, but you know.
But the boys in the film are really coming to this thing at the end as well. You know, they've kind of missed it. It's this sort of sense that it's the fag end. And I think that, I know when I was growing up, I always felt like I'd just missed that thing. And I think that's something that a lot of people can identify with.
But there's an element in that that reminded me of the end of Withnell and I. That whole thing about, you know, we're coming to the end of the greatest decade and we've singularly failed to paint it black. There is a sense that the party's happened.
Well, I'm welling up here, Mark. Come on. I mean, Withnell and I is one of my favourite films. So.
Oh, well, there we go. I think we're on the same wavelength.
Okay.
This is really nice for me.
It's going all right, isn't it? Yeah.
So have you seen it with Big Eyes? As I said, I saw it in a screening room on my own because I'm super important. But, I mean, how have you seen it in a screening with loads of people?
Beats?
Yeah.
Yeah, we've seen it a few times. We saw it in Rotterdam in a room that was a bit bigger than this one even. And it was... It worked there, but where it really worked in Glasgow, when we screened at the Glasgow Film Festival, I've never experienced anything quite like it. People were just going fucking nuts. because so many people in the audience knew what we were talking about.
And tell us about your two central characters, because you do get to know and really sort of love them during them. Tell us about them and casting them.
So the two characters are Jono and Spanner. They've been best friends for years, but... life and growing up, they come from quite different backgrounds, and their separate circumstances mean that this is kind of going to be their last big night out together, and it's quite tragic because the boys really belong together, and they're played by a young actor called Lorne McDonald, who plays Spanner, and another actor called Christian Ortega, who's actually sitting over there.
Oh, hey. Hello. Hi. You're really good.
You should ask if we come down, surely.
Well, yeah, you should. I mean, yeah.
Okay.
Hey. So how was it working with Brian? Was he everything you'd expected?
Aye. No, I had this joke with Brian after we had like finished the film, and I hadn't seen him for a while, and he'd been editing it away. And he had always talked about how Kubrick was a reference point for him in terms of doing loads and loads of takes. And then I met up for him. We all went out for dinner, and I like called him out on it. I was like, you had enough options, surely, to cut something together. And he was like, aye, but I fucking needed them. And I was like, fair.
So was it fun to make? Was it, or was it?
It was absolutely better. It was like, yeah, one of the best jobs I've ever had in my life. Because when we were filming the rave sequence, we actually threw like an actual rave in Glasgow and invited loads of people along for like, they had free tickets, but they had to dress up in like 90s clothing, and there was to be no smartphones or anything like that. And so I remember on the night we were shooting that, we were like, I don't know if people are going to turn up. Like, maybe I'll know when they'll turn up. And by like 7 o'clock, fucking people were just turning up, and it was like, yes! And so we then spent about like 3.5 hours filming in a run around like an actual party going on. And I remember like grabbing Lauren and being like, this is our job! This is our job! Yeah, so...
So, I mean, congratulations. I mean, it really works. I said, if it works for me, because I feel very, very distanced from dance. I mean, I don't dance at all. You know, I mean, I play bass. I don't dance. But I did understand what it must have felt like as a result of watching, particularly that sort of central sequence, and also because I think it's, you know, it's telling a story that's politically important, but it's telling it through the eyes of two characters who've got no interest in that at all. They're sort of bamboozled by it. So. Congratulations, that was really good. If you had to sell it to the audience, how would you sort of sum it up in a couple of sentences? What is it? What is the film?
Oh, Mark, well, I think it's... At its core, it's a love story, really, between these two boys, and they're both very charming and funny young men, and I love spending... 90 minutes in their company, but also I think it's you come away from the film really reflecting on what that period in time meant, what the Criminal Justice Act meant, and how it's relevant to the way that we live today.
Do you know what you're doing next?
I'm actually working with Kieran, the co-writer on this, and we are writing at the moment. Yeah. Another Scottish story, contemporary. That's about all I'm going to say.
And after the best gig ever, what are you doing now?
I'm just about to start rehearsals for a play up in Scotland, so yeah, I've like done my film and I'm going back to theatre.
Beats opens in
2 weeks. Craft.
Beats opens in 2 weeks, Simon. It is well worth seeing. What a treat! Thank you very much. It's funny because I said before, God, it's going to be a packed show. We've got loads of people on stage, more than I thought. Strangely enough. I mentioned Anya's father. Now, if you're a regular here at MK3D, you may remember a little while ago, I was at Fright Fest, and I went to see this film called King Cohen, which is about the life and films of Larry Cohen, and I really loved it. We did a little thing. We showed a couple of clips from it, and I talked about it a little bit, and because I was a big Larry Cohen fan, and he made so many interesting films, and I thought it was a really, really lovely documentary. Larry Cohen just passed away, which is a surprise, because I thought he was kind of indestructible and would go on forever. Let's just have a look at the trailer for King Cohen, because this is such a great film and it is such a great tribute to Larry Cohen.
shell cartridges were raining down into the streets of New York. People think that there's a terrorist attack. And he goes, get a cameraman and shoot somebody panicking.
And then the next day, there were articles about it. They went, oh, Larry, you know.
What you're really seeing is somebody who looks deeply at the present moment.
Larry's movie is not necessarily subtle. They're thoughtful. They're reflections of the world around him and the problems in that world.
All the movies I do take something which is considered benevolent and turning it into some kind of monstrosity.
What?
Every time I make a movie, they always tell me, that's not the way it's done, but I do it, and it works.
He is the true independent filmmaker. His jump out of the chopper, run and gun.
Larry is the best guerrilla filmmaker in the business.
A wild, maverick sense in the tradition of the handmade picture.
He trusts his actors, and they trust him.
The greatest daredevil Hollywood has ever seen.
The reality of life is you don't know all the answers. You don't know why these things occur. Let's face it, anybody will put up with anything if they think a movie is being shot.
Please welcome to the stage the director Steve Mitchell and the composer Joe Kramer, the creators of King Cohen. For those who didn't, I mean, I never met Larry Cohen, but my impression from the portrait of him in the film is that he was every bit as gregarious and good fun in real life as his movies were.
Yeah, Larry... I don't think we did talk about this in the movie, actually. Larry wanted to be a stand-up comedian initially, and he didn't like the hours of working as a stand-up, so he said, I've got to find another career for myself. So he started pestering people at NBC when he was a page back in the late 50s, and he wanted to be a writer. But the spirit of the performer is in Larry. You can tell it, you know, in the trailer, and we certainly get a sense of that in the movie. You know, Larry, I wish Larry was here. He would enjoy this. He would like being in front of these lights. You know, when we did a number of festivals with him and at events, and every time Larry got in front of the lights and an audience, he got about 10 years younger, and he just took control of the room, and he was, I miss him already.
I remember going to see It's Alive when it first came out in the UK, and I saw it by mistake. There was two different, it was like one of those multiplex cinemas, and I wasn't old enough to go and see it. And I had paid to see the film in the next room, and I went in at the beginning, you know, because the way it starts, it's like, oh, you're going to have a baby, yeah, great, you know, oh, just go into the delivery room, and then, and it was the best possible introduction to Larry Cohen for me. And then I you know, through reading things like Psychotronic and finding out about his career and realizing that it goes so far back. There's so much stuff that I had already seen of his that I just didn't know was Larry Cohen. I mean, it's a 360-degree career, isn't it?
Yeah, and he had a career that was completely on his own terms. This project got started. One day I was looking at the IMDb, and I was a fan of his work. I knew his TV stuff. I knew his features. It's Live was the first movie I saw theatrically. And I'm looking at his IMDb credits, and I'm going, wow, I don't know that. I don't know that. I don't know that. And this guy was incredibly prolific. And this is only the stuff that was produced. He still has, a lot of scripts that were never produced. We heard some stories about them. We said, boy, that sounded really good. But not everything gets made. But he was incredibly prolific, and my nickname for him was the Energizer Bunny. He just keeps going and going and going. He wrote every day. He always had two or three scripts in process. I mean, he was a creative machine. Joe Dante refers to him as an idea machine.
Yeah.
And I don't know that there's ever been anybody like him in terms of the volume and the work, but also his energy and his obsessiveness for getting things done.
I want to show a clip from the film. This is because a lot of the film is about conflicting narratives about he said, she said, something like this. And this is I think one, you know, a really, really well done sequence. This is two different versions of what may or may not have happened in the particular arrangement of a stunt. It kind of speaks for itself. I don't need to set it up. It explains itself. Enjoy this.
It does.
Jesus Christ, man, they got guns!
Every time there'd be a stunt that had to be done, I would have to do it first. Say, okay, Fred, you're in this cab, and you get to the corner, open the door and throw yourself out onto the sidewalk. Threw myself out on the sidewalk. Yeah, that's it. You'll be fine. Okay, Cohen, you do it first. And I go in the cab. I throw myself out of the cab on the sidewalk. Okay. Well, that was it. No problem.
Well, he didn't fall out of no cab. I promise you that. Larry did not fall out of a cab.
Then I go around the corner where he couldn't see me and go, Christ, this is terrible.
Larry Cohen is no athlete. No matter how he jumps out of a cab, it's going to be wrong. So it don't really matter. He's going to hurt himself no matter what he does. Stepping out of the cab, he might hurt himself.
So, okay, let's do it, Fred. And then he go around the corner. He throw himself out onto the sidewalk. He get up. You're right, nothing to it. Then he go around the corner where I couldn't see him. And gee, that Cohen, I hate that bastard.
That's a Larry myth. That's a Larry myth.
But that's the whole picture. We just one-upping each other all the time. I'd say, I'll do any stunt that you want first.
Larry Cohen did not fall out of a cab, and if he told you that he fell out of the cab first, he's a lie.
I mean, honestly, that is just a taste of what you get from King Cohen. The whole film is like that. And I said it was the favourite thing that I saw it for. I mean, I told you that at the time when
yes.
I saw it, how much I enjoyed it. I really, really loved it. Joe, you are an extremely well-respected composer. I mean, you know, scores for Mission Impossible, Rogue Nation, and Jack Reacher. And what are you working on at the moment? What are you doing here now? You're here working, right?
Yeah, working. I am finishing up a score via the internet for Lucky McKee for his new film, Kindred Spirits.
Wow.
So we're right in the finishing stretch for that before we start mixing the movie. And I have a relationship with a wonderful company here in England that does production music. So we make the music in advance, and then companies and productions that don't hire a composer per se, they get music that they need from this collection of music that we record. And it's really top notch because I can do a 90-piece orchestra at Abbey Road, so you know, or Air or wherever. So I got to do like the big session on Friday, and you know, then I couldn't lift my arm for 3 days from conducting.
How did you get into film compositions? We've had quite a few composers on the show, and people come in through very, very different. Did you always know that you wanted to compose for film?
No, I wanted to be Paul McCartney, but he already has a Paul McCartney in his band, so. I decided to try to be John Williams instead. You know, the first two records I bought were Magical Mystery Tour and the score to Superman the movie. So I chucked out the Beatles and chased movies. I was lucky, too, because I grew up in upstate New York in a very small town. And so as a seventh grader, which would be, you know, I was about 13, I was friends with 18-year-olds who were making films on Super 8.
Right.
And so they would cast me in these movies because I was a hot-headed little kid, and you know, they need like an energetic kid to make their Amblin movie, you know, their 80s film. And my dad was an amateur musician, so I had a recording studio in my house, and I was like, what do you do for your music in your movies? And Scott Storm, the director, was like, well, you know, just take my Tangerine Dream records and needle drop them in. It's like, well, aren't you going to get sued? And he's like, well, no one's going to see these movies anyway. And I was like, yeah, but I could do original music for you. So I was like 15 and, you know, scoring movies. And I just sort of fell into it that way, and it was all instinctive. And then I went to Berkeley in Boston, and I discovered there was a whole craft behind it of conducting and mathematically counting frames and minutes and seconds. And when I realized you could have a sort of control over the whole thing, I became obsessed with it. And it appeals to my mathematical mind and the sort of putting everything in its place. And yet there's also this mysterious artistic quality to it where you're trying to sort of take an oboe and make it, you know, use it to make you feel sad or excited or tense, you know.
Do you still enjoy it, or is it work?
No, I love it, actually. I love it so much I tend to do it even when I'm not getting paid for it. So, you know, John Powell's a composer. He has a great quote, which is, nobody ever pays me to write music. They pay me a lot to rewrite music, but they never pay me to write it. And that's sort of, you know, the rewriting can get, you know, like anything, you can drill something to death and you can get frustrated. But no, I love it. I mean, it's my favorite job I've ever had.
And what's your favorite film score?
As a fan?
Yeah.
Well, to disappoint you all, it's Star Wars, you know. But I was the right age when it came out, you know. Superman the movie, which has just been reissued on CD in a brand new remaster, is fantastic. Chinatown, Taking Pelham 1-2-3, David Shire,
which is a
all
great,
the President's Men, you know.
But Taking Pelham 1-2-3 is often overlooked, and that is an absolutely brilliant score.
And
absolutely brilliant score.
And it's so intellectually smart the way he did it. It's a whole thing we could do next year, episode 44. We'll just talk about that.
I just, you know, I just wish there was like an intelligent film music radio show on a digital station.
Yeah, because
play some of these.
I've been looking for one to host me forever.
Obviously, there is a sense of sadness because, you know, because Larry is gone. But I watched the doc again, and it just feels like such a celebration. It's such an upbeat piece of work. Do you feel like it's captured his spirit? Because I think, like, you know, he's gone, but he's still here.
Yeah, well, this sequence that you watched before, that was one of the first things my editor and I cut. And it was kind of a tone setter for us.
Yeah.
And what was nice, you know, a lot of fiction movies, they'll set something up in the first act and pay it off in the third act. And we had a couple of opportunities for what we call He Said, He Said.
Yeah.
And we had that with Moriarty, Michael Moriarty at one point, and then we have another one with Fred later. So it felt very organic. But, you know, Larry was always a very upbeat guy. He could be cranky. He was a social critic, and I think that's the thread in all of his films.
Yeah.
But his energy and who he was kind of steered me to make it the way that I made it. I mean, Larry's had tragedy in his life, and I talked to him about it, I talked to his wife about it, but I did not want to go there. I wanted to focus on the career and the fact that this guy did as much as he did. And of course, he gave me a hard time. He said, you should have made it a miniseries, you didn't talk about my theater work. Larry, I'm in London. He did theater here. He's very proud of it. But, you know, the thing that I tried to tell Larry was, Larry, I made it a certain way, at a certain length, so people would be more interested in you. That they give them enough so they want to hunt down the films.
Yeah.
And the other thing that was nice, and I found this out when we had screenings, and some friends would be there with their wives, who did not know who Larry was. They would come up to me and say, "He's great. He's funny. He's interesting. I never heard of him. I don't know the movies, but I really liked him."
Yeah.
And so, in a sense, I think it's a pretty fair celebration of who he was.
Yeah.
And there will never be another Larry Cohen as well, just in terms of who he was and what he did and the amount of what he did. Yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Okay, now we're gonna stay with a musical theme. You know, we've had Beats and we've had Joe talking about composition. Did any of you go and see Eighth Grade over the weekend? Yeah, and did you love it to pieces? It's just like, it's the best thing ever. And I mean, there's so much to love about it. It's this fantastic, the first feature by Bo Burnham, who I know about Bo Burnham because I have a teenage son. And this teenage son kept saying to me, "You have to watch these videos by this guy." And I was just thinking, yeah, of course I don't want to do that because that's a teenager telling me to do it. But I did, and they were brilliant. And then Jack Howard is here today, and Jack is a huge fan as well. And because Jack is half my age and is my kind of my other son. Anyway, the film opened, I don't know why I went off on that. The film opened over the weekend, and I reviewed it on the radio show, and I talked about the score, which is by Anna Meredith, which is such an important part of the film, and I just love the score, and I've been playing it on the Scarlet radio show every Saturday, 1 till 3. And then again repeated Monday, 7 till 9. And we got in touch with Anna Meredith, whose score it is, and said, "Is there any chance you could come on the show?" She said, "Yes, please welcome to the stage Anna Meredith."
Thank you.
I'm so thrilled that you're here. I just loved Eighth Grade to Pieces. How did you get involved in it?
Well, it's my first score. And I think Bo, you know, who's obviously a really musical guy as well, had, I think he'd done some temp music for the score, but he always knew that he wasn't going to score it. And he had...
So he had never planned to do it himself, because obviously he is a very accomplished keyboard player and he started doing, you know, musical comedy and all that stuff.
Yeah, I think that idea, I mean, when I actually eventually heard his temp score, I was thinking, oh shit, it's quite good. he knew he didn't want to do it, and he had quite a specific idea of the kind of thing he wanted. He wanted a classically trained composer who maybe was doing their first film, but who worked now in electronics, and he kept talking about this kind of warmth. So, you know, initially feeling quite complimented, by the end it kind of felt like, all right, well, that leaves me. I think he listens to a lot of music, so he'd heard a few things and got in touch.
And it's the story, it's a really sort of brilliantly specific evocation of a period of life. She's 13, she's at the end of the eighth grade, and she's grown up in what Bo Burnham described as a culture which they did not create, but they have had forced upon them, in which this Generation Z, as it's referred to sometimes, are forced to sort of live their life online. But there is this tension all the way through the film that in real life she has real difficulty speaking to her peers, but she has this kind of online life. But nobody's watching her videos other than herself. So it's, and I think the genius of the film is that it doesn't matter whether you're, you know, male, female, old, you know, whatever. It just feels terribly universal. And when I got in touch with you to ask you to do the show, you said, the other thing is, it's about kindness.
I was a bit drunk, but yes. it's a bit much. But yeah, I feel it is about, you know, I have yet to, you know, I've seen this film a lot, and everybody comes out and goes, oh God, that was me. Oh, that was totally me. And myself included. And it does, you know, she is so trying so hard, and through, you know, she's warm and she wants to communicate through honesty and warmth. And yeah, so I do think on some level it is about kindness.
And also, despite the fact that the film depicts some very, very sort of difficult social interactions, there are characters in it that are kind of the, you know, talismans of that kindness. There's a lovely scene at the end when she goes with the chicken nugget scene, as it's been described, which is one of the most uplifting things I think I've ever seen. There's another character, an older character, who sort of has a suggestion of what her life might become. So amidst all the hardship, and the thing that your score does is it's got heart and soul, but it also, it's very good at capturing her anxiety, at capturing the sort of the, how do you do it?
I think how Bo described it is, he said, I'd like take her really seriously and lean into her concerns and her euphoria and her, you know, so the things that when you're 13 about the palm sweating horror of talking to the cool kids or of trying to work out what to wear to see the cool older guy and the girl in the mall that you're going to hang out with, you know, those are real problems to her. And so he said, you know, I don't want like a cutesy ukulele, you know, score that steps back and looks as this as a bigger cultural thing. I want you to be with her in that moment, feeling that anxiety, and you know, and the film does have moments that I think that are such relief you feel when things go well for her, and such the horror of going to the high school with the cooler older kids, you know, just those things which we have all experienced and are so relatable. And I think he just said, you know, write strong music that, you know, when you see the film, it's music's loud and it's given a lot of space, and you know, he refers to it quite often as another character in the film, and you know, it gives, I think if I was flattering myself, I'd say he was trying to give her weight.
I want to show a clip from the film, which is the pool party clip. And what's happened, for those of you who haven't seen it, is that essentially she has been invited to a pool party of a kind of cool kid, but she's only been invited because the mother of the cool kid said, oh, yeah, you're the daughter of so-and-so. Oh, you must come to the party. And the cool kid was like, I really mustn't come to the party. And her father has said to her, yeah, you must go out and put yourself out there. That's the phrase he keeps using, but just put yourself out there, not having any real sense of what a terrifying prospect that is. And in this scene, we see her, it starts with her having a panic attack, and then it goes into her, you know, walking into this kind of wildlife environment also, almost. And your music is doing such a lot of the work. Can you say something about the music before we watch it? And you know the scene I'm referring
yeah.
to.
So yeah. Yeah, I mean, that was actually an existing track that he used for that one that I'd done before. But it's one of my favourite usages of this track because I feel it's like Hieronymus Bosch. Like, you're just seeing, like, the seventh circles of hell. Like, the scene through her eyes, the absolute horror of this ill-fitting swimsuit and, like, gazing out upon these scenes. So, yeah, it's just something very dramatic and, yeah, just, like, opening a door to hell.
Do you write when you're... Oh, yeah, actually, move your chair slightly.
Sorry.
It's because I shout. Do you write at a keyboard, or do you write when you're walking around? How does it come to you?
I do a lot of drawing first, where I draw for any music I write, whether it's an orchestral piece or a remix or a piece of my band or increasingly now film stuff, I'd like to draw the shapes, sort of the pacing of the material and the kind of dramatic energy of it. So I draw a line that's a timeline, and then I'll be drawing these kind of graphic shapes that for me map out the sort of linear contours of the music. And for me, with the music I write, pacing is the most important thing. So I'm placing where certain objects are going to go. You know, what are you building up to? What are you contrasting with? So I have these sketches, which are my kind of maps, and I'll always refer back to them. And then from there, I will go to classical notation software and write, even though that score is all electronic, it's all written initially on Sibelius, which is a sort of designed for notation score, because that's kind of what my training is. My training is in notation rather than production, so I want to make sure the actual nuts and bolts, the crotchets and quavers work, rather than I know that my skill set isn't amazing effects or production, it's about getting good crotchets.
And those drawings, do you keep them all? Do you have, like, all the drawings of what a track looks like?
Yeah, I mean, some of them are not as sexy as you'd imagine, but there's you know, I've got some of them somewhere. I mean, I do these some on a whiteboard, but then after a while I thought, oh my God, these are going to be worth billions. So I've started keeping them. Yeah, and so for each piece I have a sketch where I, like...
No, I'm just, you know, I'm thinking that's a curated exhibition waiting to happen, surely, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, I feel that you could look, like, so just now I'm writing a band album, and that's 11 tracks, all quite different. You know, some have beats, some don't, some have vocals, some don't. So each one has a very clear graphic shape for me.
Yeah.
And I like to be able to see those shapes and then work out how they fit next to each other. And it's just storytelling. It's how, when we've all got a punchline or an amazing crazy thing that happens in the story about when you went to the pub or whatever, that you, when you're telling people, you time it right. So it's just about contextualizing musical objects rather than hilarious anecdotes.
You make it sound a lot simpler than I'm sure it is. I mean, I've tried to write songs and things like that, and I think in my whole life I've written about 25 songs. They're all the same song. I just write the same shorter or sort of longer version of it. But there is, I mean, listening to Eighth Grade, I do, it reminds, I mean, I was thinking, I remember the first time I saw Midnight Express and the George M. Roeder score, and I was remembering the first time I saw Sorcerer with Tangerine Dream, and I had that same feeling about it's organically in the body of the film, and I just can't imagine how you would have sat down and written any of it, to be honest. And that's part of the reason it works for me, is that it's kind of, it's mysterious.
Well, he gave me the space to be strong with it. You know, there wasn't much kind of, can you tone it down a bit? And he lets music sit, and so I he was saying a lot of the time, if you have ideas about, he recut some stuff after I'd written it to fit around, because I kept sort of prudishly saying, actually it'd be much better if we had two more beats here because the cycle doesn't quite move. and he was very accommodating and supportive of what I was trying to do, and I don't know, it felt very instinctive. I drew my little shapes and. For what we were trying to do, but she's so, you feel so protective of her watching this film, and I felt really honored to be given a place to kind of make her world a bit more hellish or a bit more exciting or nice or whatever.
Do you see yourself, because you said, you know, increasingly film, and obviously your music, we heard it in Favourite, and it's, you know, you, is that what the future is for you, film music?
I mean, I'm really lucky. I have a really eclectic career, so I still make most of my living from classical composition, writing commissions for orchestras and stuff, and then I perform with my band, but I think the third balancing side of that is, and it's looking like there's going to be a lot more film and telly stuff coming up, which is really exciting for me.
What are you doing now?
I'm finishing up the album, which is a very rare night out for me, big deal. Have a beer. And then I'm going to be doing music for a telly thing after this, I hope.
Okay. Did you punch the air when Barack Obama put Eighth Grade in his top movies of 2018?
I did a girly squeal.
Yeah. I was just trying to imagine what Trump's movies would be. And they, you know, like Armageddon re-release or something. I don't know, it's just... I mean, but that must be such a brilliantly vindicating moment when you think, okay, fine, there's being liked by film critics, but Barack Obama, that's pretty high up the tree of getting praise.
When you're thinking, Barack Obama's heard my music, you know, that's some... Maybe, you know, I'm sure he doesn't care either way, but, yeah, that made my Christmas.
And in terms of other film composers that you listen to and you like, who do you see as interesting? Other than Joe Kramer, obviously.
I mean, obviously. I have a terrible thing that I don't listen to any music because I find that when I'm trying to write, which is most of the time, that I find it really distracting and unhelpful in terms of trying to psych myself up to be feeling compositionally strong, that if I hear someone else's thing, I'm like, oh shit, that's really good, and, you know, what am I going to do now? So I'm more in a kind of podcast, long audiobooks situation for the music I listen to, because I don't want to see what other people do. I just want to try and do it on my own terms. So of course I see films and, you know, what Mika Levy does and you know, Johnny Greenwood stuff, and, you know, there's lots of people doing interesting stuff, but I don't seek out other people's music, which sounds awful. I'm quite ashamed, but
no, I'm just very pleased that you listen to podcasts and audiobooks, because I have skin in both those games. You know, if you ever find that what you want to do is spend 8 hours listening to a film critic telling you about his life in rock and roll bands and not make it, there's a fantastic audio book of How Does It Feel, which I think because there's no music in it at all, so you wouldn't find it distracting. It would just be great. Anyway, listen, I'm so glad you came to the show. I love the film. I think your score is a central part of it, and I do think every now and then that film critics don't focus enough on the music in movies. But there is no way you could watch Eighth Grade without coming out of it and going, the music is such a central part. You've done a brilliant job on it, and I'm really pleased to meet you. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. You're listening to the Kermode on Film podcast, and if you're enjoying it, please remember to subscribe. This week's edition comes live from the BFI South Bank, where every month I do my MK3D show. If you like the sound of it, then go to the BFI website to get tickets. The shows are every month, but do be warned, they do sell out rather quickly. Next up, Benedict Erlingsson made his name with the international hit of Horses and Men. His new film, Woman at War, is a tale of a divided soul. In one life, she's a singing teacher. In another, she's an eco-warrior. I love the movie, and I found out more about it when Benedict Erlingsson joined me live on stage at MK3D. So you've come here hot foot from... you were doing a screening at Picture House just before, yes?
Yes. And it's ongoing. I have a Q&A after this Q&A.
So you've just sort of... You've fitted us in, and you're very busy.
I will repeat my answers. They're well rehearsed.
So. Well, let me see if I can ask you a question that you haven't been asked before. Which was your favourite Osmond brother?
Wow. What is Osmond brother? What is that?
Just tell us a little bit about the story. I mean, it's a story of somebody who is, you know, involved in sort of eco-warrior stuff, but it's a story about her, but it's a story about her as well. Tell us what the film is about, Benedict.
No.
Okay.
No, sorry. Of course, I will do it. But it's very hard. This is a film And I hope it's a family film. It's a feel-good film about immediate threat that is approaching. Of course, I started to think about, you know, saving the world. You know, I have got a Messias complex. and then I thought about films that are about saving the world. And these films are usually action films. Yeah. With a hero that, you know, gets away with both the money and the girl, or gets what he wants and what he needs and so on. And these films are really a fairy tales. So I thought about, you know, fairy tale. A fairy tale about this very complex and very serious matter. A film that could maybe give us hope. So, they called it environmental action art house thriller with a lot of music.
That's...
Something.
That's a really catchy tagline. One of the things that I love most about the film is the way in which you've put the music, the live music, into the landscape. So, as our heroine is walking around through different situations, sometimes in her room, sometimes out, you start hearing incidental music, and then you suddenly realise that you're going past somebody playing the piano, somebody playing the drum kit, and somebody playing whatever that thing's called. Euphony. Is it a euphony?
Yes, sousaphone.
Sousaphone. Yeah. And that's like a kind of Greek chorus theatrical thing. Tell us about that.
Well, it's a very easy agreement to make with publicum, and we are doing it all this time in theater, and we do it in the opera when there is band between you and the players.
Yeah.
And but in this case, I'm also, of course, visualizing the inner struggle of the character. At the same time, this is a device to smile to the audience, to remind us that this is a fairy tale. This is a little bit like Bertolt Brecht, Verfremdung, to distance us.
Alienation.
So it's, I think film can be very, I think filmmakers should be very more inspired by German theater. I think there's a lot to get from them.
Because I was kind of reminded of the joke in Blazing Saddles when they're driving across the desert and they turn up and there is the whole band playing the theme in the desert. Yeah. And I thought originally that was, you know, what's lovely about it is it's not comedic. It's actually really soulful and is part of the drama. And there's a sequence when she's like in a small office. Yeah. And the drummer is sitting behind her, and you get a sense that things are going to go badly because the drummer looks like he's about to start playing something.
Yeah, it's the principle of the choir. The choir is not only talking to the audience. The choir, Greek choir, also talk to the protectionist, warns him, you know, try to influence him. So in that sense, it's they are breaking if there is a rule. So in this film, you a little bit have a deconstruction. You start with a film, it's a film about with musicians live playing the music. Okay, yeah, now what they see her, she sees them. Yeah. Okay, it's a film, she sees them. And then they start to influence her, turning on the TV and so on. So you're making new agreement. and I like that as a storyteller and also as an audience, when there's a new agreement made to me during the process of the story.
You have such a fantastic central character. Tell me about the actress that plays your central character, because you've known her for...
Yes, we are childhood friends. We were slaves together in a child fabric called theater. As 10 years old, we played, we were in children's play in Iceland. It was a children's play about domestic violence. How Scandinavian can you get? and the concept was, of course, that children played adults and adults played children.
Okay.
So we were playing adults in this play about domestic violence. So that was, and then we worked together and we were in college together in university. Yeah, everybody, of course, is if they are not related, they are lovers or ex-lovers. but we are not lovers. One of my few relationships. We come from a small community, and we have been like a professional siblings. And Haldóra is our Sarah Bernhardt. She is a fantastic actress, and she acts usually men also. So he has done Don Quixote and even played in Wait for Godot, Vladimir, and so on. Mm.
I've never been to Iceland, and you know, there's a joke in the film that, you know, we're probably cousins, and
yeah.
I mean, is there a specific Icelandic cultural outlook? I mean, what is the, do you see yourself as being part of a particular tradition? You have a particular form of comedy or anything, or is it just?
No, you know, I saw an English documentary about where is the Viking culture.
Yeah.
You know, it was, wow, the Vikings were here in Europe. Where is the culture? What is left of this culture? And apparently nothing is left. You know, it means that the Viking culture is, in essence, you know, the ability to adapt.
Yeah.
To use the best instruments, the French swords, you know, your own ships, you know, whatever works. It's a scientific, very modern, technological approach. It's modernity,
yeah.
You know, it's the modern humans, you know. So we are very, you know, Viking in that sense. But of course, yes, there is, of course, like in all cultures, you know, something, a niche. But, you know, this film is local, global, global, local, you know.
Can you tell me an Icelandic joke? No, seriously, can you tell me an Icelandic joke?
You should have prepared me, because we say, you know, we sometimes credit us with something that you think you're very good in, the British.
But, oh, I thought you meant me personally. Sorry,
no, but we credit for us. It goes to Snorri Sturluson, you know, it is the, in our sagas, it is the art of understatement. Okay. You know, that is really, you know, for us, top humor. So that, you know.
So the more understated, the more hilarious.
The more funny, and the more hilarious. Yeah,
fantastic.
Yeah.
And have you seen the film play with audience? I mean, I think it's a really terrific piece of work. I liked Horses and Men as well, but actually I have to say I preferred this touched me more. Yeah. I thought there was stuff in it that was really moving, stuff in it that was very, very funny, but I found it really touched me. Have you seen it playing with audiences, and how do audiences respond to it? Do they?
Yes, I've seen it play with audience in Ukraine and France and elsewhere, and I've been very, you know, surprised. Even, you know, people are laughing to something that I thought was maybe an Icelandic joke, but is apparently universal. And that is the paradox. We are, of course. So it was really incredible, and even clapping in the middle of the film, you know, on the time of change. So for me, it was really warmth experience, especially in Ukraine. Yeah. You know, they were really, you know, with it there.
And it's Ukrainian singers, the singers that we see, yes. And are they singing? They are singing live whilst you're filming.
Yeah, everything was taken up live on set as much as possible. And then we took before and after and so on. So we were really, I can have a long lecture about my preparation in the musical department.
No, that's fine. I mean, I was just...
But the poetry is mine, mostly. It's very funny. I studied Ukrainian folk songs, and I wrote my own folk songs, you know? So it's my first debut as a poet, you know, Ukrainian poem. So it makes some sense,
Well, listen, I think the movie's terrific. It opens on Friday. Thank you so much for fitting us into your fantastically busy show. What are you off to now? So you've just done the premiere in London. You've done the thing now, and you're going on now?
Now I come home and write something new.
Do you know what you're going to do next? Do you know what
Yes, but it's a secret.
Can you give me just like an understated, you know, hilariously Icelandic hint of what it might be?
Human problem.
Benedict Erlingsson talking about Woman at War, which is currently playing in UK cinemas. Now, a couple of months ago, Stephen Merchant came on the MK3D live show to talk about his new film, Fighting With My Family, a tale of a wrestling family based on a true life story. And back then, we didn't have time to put that interview on the Kermode on Film podcast, but I really liked the movie and he was a great guest. So, better late than never, here's Stephen Merchant talking about Fighting With My Family.
I've never fist bumped a guest before.
Well, you said you were a little under the weather, so I thought that was safe.
Oh, I see. Thank you. That's what you're doing. Okay,
for my health. Yeah.
You know, I've forgotten my illness already.
Yes. No, I haven't.
No. So I saw the film this way. I think it's really, really good fun. I really enjoyed it. It's a very entertaining story. How close to the truth is the story?
It's perhaps closer than you would imagine. I've compressed time a little bit. The real story probably stretched over about 3.5 years. There was a lot of sort of her working her way through the kind of training part of WWE, which, you know, would have made the film very long, and lots of sort of montages and lots of 6 months later, 3 weeks later, which I'm not a fan of, and her kind of walking through the snow and then through the spring, you know, to try and convey that amount of time. But so there was a compression of time, but all the kind of the sort of significant narrative beats of the film are true, including the interactions with The Rock, which you might think were kind of done for sort of stunt casting, but that stuff happened as well. So it's surprisingly close.
What was it like meeting The Rock? Because obviously he's involved in the production side as well. So I've always thought he looks lovely.
Well, I don't know if you remember, Mark. I'm sure if we were to ask you your top 10 films, you would probably include 2010's Tooth Fairy, starring myself and Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
Yeah,
you're welcome.
Yep.
And so I've known him since then. I knew him back in the day when he was still in shape. And I hit it off with him. He and I got on well doing that film. And so he was as lovely then. I wish I could report that he's a monster in real life, but he's a really wonderful man and sickeningly charismatic and talented, and it makes me angry.
And what are the world wrestling? What WWE stands for? World wrestling, the American
World
version.
World Wrestling Entertainment.
Okay, fine. So there's a very specific line about, you know, it's all fake. It's not faked. It's fixed.
That's
and
right.
The thing is, you know, if it was what are they like to deal with, and are they at all cagey about the fake fixed thing?
Well, my first interest, I didn't know anything about wrestling before I started this film.
You're not a wrestler yourself.
I'm not a wrestler myself, despite the physique. I have a very similar workout regime to The Rock,
yes.
Obviously, but I went into writing rather than wrestling. So I didn't know anything about it. So I spent time with the family initially, and then I went over to WWE in America. I actually went to WrestleMania with The Rock, which was extraordinary. The man came out and set fire to an 8-foot sign of his name with a flamethrower, and he milked that for 10 minutes. It was extraordinary. So we had to involve WWE. We actually began life with Film 4, but we had to involve WWE because they own certain parts of the story and the rights to her sort of persona and so on. It's a little bit like, I imagine, the magic circle. You know, you need to
of
win their trust. You need to convince them that you're not there to sort of mock them. And
which the film doesn't. I mean, the film is very clear that there is physical hurt and pain and gain involved in all of this.
Well, you know, there is a version of this film which is a sort of, you know, it is a satire of wrestling. But the thing I discovered was that the family love it so much. It's so important to them in a really meaningful way. And they talk about it like a religion, like it really saved them from some dark times in their lives. And it seemed to me that if your dream is to be a wrestler and then I start mocking wrestling, then the kind of the whole impetus for why she's trying to pursue this falls away. And it reminded me of the story reminded me of things like Billy Elliot, where you don't need to like ballet to enjoy the movie. And it seemed to me that if you're kind of snobby or snooty about wrestling, then the whole kind of raison d'etre of the film falls apart, really.
What about the physicality of it? Because we do see Florence Pugh getting thrown to the... I mean, obviously, there must be a certain amount of stunt doubling, but I've read in interviews with her, she said that she did get quite thrown around.
Yes, she went off to the same facility in Florida that the real girl trained at, and she spent 2 weeks there with a guy who plays her brother, Jack Loudon, and they learned to wrestle as best you can in a couple of weeks, and they did as much of it as we would allow them to and that they could do, and there was some doubling for the sort of backflips and some of the bigger moves, but she does an extraordinary amount of it, including she actually, on her fourth day of filming, walked out in front of 20,000 fans at the Staples Center in LA, real wrestling fans, and to recreate one of Paige's real matches. And it took enormous nerve to do that, and I have nothing but admiration. I was a bag of nerves, and she wouldn't let me anywhere near her because I was making her nervous. And she just came out there and just was just ice cool and just did these incredible moves. And she said at one point she was lying on the floor and she saw an 8-year-old boy just screaming, "You suck!" And
we've all had that.
Yeah, we've all had that. Yeah.
We have a clip that I want to show. There's a certain repetition with the trailer because the trailer is so well cut that there are bits of all that's already
on. Yes, every single scene.
But I think it is nice to see this at its full length. This is when our two young heroes get to America and they bump into The Rock for the first time. So here we go.
How about what The Rock wants? The Rock wants you to go out there, take no prisoners, have no regrets, have no fear, lay it all out on the line. Because if you don't do that, The Rock is going to find your friend Mary Poppins. He's going to take her umbrella. Yeah, he's going to shine it up real nice. He's gonna turn that sumbitch sideways and stick it straight up your candy asses. There's your advice. Straight out of the jabroni beating, pie eating, trail blazing, eyebrow raising, entertaining the globe never hotter, talking to two rejects from Harry Potter. So that's how you win over the crowd.
Yeah.
There's a moment in that when he says the thing about, you know, you look like you're straight out of Oliver Twist, can I? Which always reminds me of the Bill Hicks thing about British hooligans. We're the hooligans, you know, penny loafers and no socks. What was the most difficult thing about directing the film? I mean, obviously there's all the sort of wrestling stuff, but what's the most difficult thing about directing the film?
Everything. We had a very compressed prep time. So we had 5 weeks to prepare the film, and we were shooting on two sides of the Atlantic. We made a lot of wrestling, and so it was very frantic. You know, there was a lot of sort of... I've heard directing described as being... It's at the best of times, like you're being chased down a hill by a boulder and you're just trying not to get crushed. Perhaps that's where Spielberg got the opening of Indiana Jones from. And that's sort of certainly how it felt, because so that was very tough, and the wrestling sequences are very hard because we wanted them to feel authentic, but we didn't have the luxury of days and days to shoot them, and so
they do look authentic. I do. Well, I did genuinely believe I was watching people beating each other up.
Yes. Well, I appreciate that, and also you're obviously anxious all the time about the performers getting injured, yeah. Which is very, very tough. The sequence I was mentioning earlier, in which Florence goes out in front of those 20,000 fans, we had the WWE gave us 1 hour. At this, after a real event had happened, and The Rock very sweetly, I call him The Rock, he very sweetly came down and emceed the event, but we only had an hour, and I said to him, please don't get carried away. And he went out in the ring and he did 20 minutes on the mic, and he was ad-libbing, he was doing the catchphrases, can you smell? And I was outside the ring thinking, yeah, we can smell what you're cooking, mate, get out the ring. It was so stressful. He didn't set fire to his name, thankfully. But so yes, it was just a very, it was very tough.
I have to say that one of the reasons it's lovely to have you on the show is that I've been directed by you.
That's right, in Extras.
Yeah, yes. It was fabulous. And I remember the direction you gave me because it was, I was playing me. Yep. And you said, just be you. And I thought that was the cut right to the heart of it. So thanks very much. Thanks.
It's very much what I said to The Rock.
Yes, it was great. Just be. Now, we also asked you to choose a scene from a film that had sort of been an inspiration to you. And you chose a film that I really love. What did you choose?
Well, I actually used to do film criticism years ago when I first started.
Because you were at college with James King, and James King, who of course is mini me, young me, you did a radio show together.
We did a radio show together, and then when I went back to my hometown of Bristol, I used to write for this magazine, and I used to do film reviewing, but I was very young, and so the more senior critics would send me off to see films they weren't terribly interested in seeing or hadn't heard of. And one of them was this film called Swingers. Oh. With Vince Vaughn and Jon Favreau, and it was the first time I'd seen either of those people.
Yeah.
And it was the first time I'd seen a film where I felt for the first time, oh, I think maybe I could do this. Because it was a bunch of friends who'd got together and they had sort of drawn from their own life. They'd shot it very cheaply and quickly in LA. It felt very raw and from their lived experience. I was a little younger than them, but I felt a great affinity with it.
Yeah.
And I didn't know who any of these guys were, and it just blew me away. And the fact that, you know, Vince Vaughn is now in my movie feels like the end of some journey that I've been on. And it was just a film that really resonated with me and struck me. And like I say, it was a big kind of motivator for me getting into this side of the camera.
There was a period after Swingers came out that everybody would do that thing about you're so money, you're so money, which was a phrase I had never heard before. Had you heard it before?
No, I hadn't. And I don't even know if it was a thing. Was it even something? I don't know whether...
Well, it was after that. Right, you're so money. I was thinking, who said that? It's in Swingers. You chose a scene, and it,
it's a slightly long scene, but we are going to let it run long because the gag plays out over sort of 3 minutes. Do you want to say anything about, you said, do we need to set this up? Do you want to say anything about it before we show it?
You know, for those that haven't seen it or don't remember, you know, it's about kind of the dating scene in LA in the early 90s, mid-90s. And
but it's not swingers like we think of swinging. It's swingers as in they swing, as opposed to
yes, exactly. Which
they
was
swing.
It was very confusing. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Which may have been the reason they sent me to see the film. not because I'm a fan of swinging, just because they thought it was going to be about that. But yes, it's about these kind of, you know, these guys and their sort of ill-fated dating exploits. And Jon Favreau plays a sort of lovelorn guy who has just broken up, and he's met a girl in a bar, and now he's calling her. Although he's been told by his friends he should really wait 3 days, but he's called her as soon as he got home.
Hi, this is Nikki. Leave a message.
Hi, Nikki. This is Mike. Could you just call me when you get in? I'm going to be up for a while, and I'd just rather speak to you in person instead of trying to fit it all into... Fuck! Nikki and Mike, this just isn't working out. I think you're great, but maybe we should just take some time off from each other. It's not you, it's me, it's what I'm going through. All right, it's only been 6 months.
Mike?
Nikki, great! Did you just walk in, or were you listening all along?
Don't ever call me again.
Wow. I guess you're home.
I know you have to rush to, because I know you've got premiere stuff to attend to, but it's funny watching that. I hadn't thought of it, but there is a similarity with The Office in that it's really painful.
Right.
I mean, it's funny, but it really hurts.
Absolutely. And and I think it that was one of the influences on us. And Ricky and I, actually, when we were doing The Office, we would often quote swingers, and we couldn't remember if it was things we and our friends had said or if it was from the movie, you know, because we just really felt, I don't know, it just felt so authentic and so real. And what I love about it is that it's excruciating because it feels such an authentic, real experience. And I think I love that when comedy has jeopardy and drama. You know, he just wants to meet a nice girl and it to go well. He's been out of the dating game, and the fact that he's trying so hard is his kind of Achilles heel, you know. And it's a very, very funny, appealing scene.
And the thing that you managed to do with the Fight With My Family is that you take us into this area that I think most of us would never have gone to a WWE convention, but I do feel like I'm watching people that I believe in actually in those situations, which I think is, you know, that's a really smart trick to pull off, because the danger is you think when you go over to America you're gonna lose it, but you don't at all. And then of course when Vince Vaughn turns up, it's completely the right character for him. So I think you did a terrific job. If you had to just say a quick word to the audience to encourage them to come and see Fighting With My Family, which there is a premiere here later on tonight, well, the match is completely sold out, but how would you sell it to the audience?
Well, you know, it's a true story, and I think, you know, hopefully it's very funny, but I think it is very emotional, and that's something that I love in movies, is going on that kind of emotional journey. And I think, you know, if you're laughing at the beginning, and even if you have a slightly kind of, you know, sneery view of wrestling, as I did, I think by the end you'll be won over to this family and to this girl and her journey, and I hope even by the end perhaps shedding a little tear, as I did when I went to see another film that they sent me to see back in those days reviewing, which was The Bridges of Madison County, which I remember crying, weeping during that film.
When Clint Eastwood takes a lot of photographs of bridges.
That's right, yeah. Please. Oh, no. No, you see, you're exactly the kind of sneering critic that meant...
Here's another bridge.
When the credits were rolling in that film, I was in tears, and I didn't want the other critics, the hardened guys like you, to see me. So I stayed during all of the credits so they wouldn't see me in the lobby crying. And I was like, yeah, I'll just wait and see who the best boy is. And I was in tears. Anyway, my hope is that you'll... hopefully this will entertain you perhaps more than it did you, Bridges of Madison County. But anyway, yes, it's a very heartwarming story.
Actually,
it's a Rocky-style underdog story with some laughs and some tears. And it's and anyway, there you are.
You should definitely put it on the poster. It's funnier and more entertaining than The Bridges of Madison County. And I'd like to say that although I didn't cry once in The Bridges of Bloody Madison County, who knew there were so many bridges in Madison County, I did cry whilst watching Fight With My Family.
Oh, great.
I did,
well, that's good.
Absolutely,
well, I appreciate that.
Thank you. Have a heart of stone. Ladies and gentlemen, the fabulous Stephen Merchant.
Thank you, guys. Thank you.
Well, there we are. That brings us to the end of a packed Kermode on Film podcast. Thanks so much for downloading and listening. If you enjoyed it, please remember to subscribe. And as I said before, if you like the sound of those MK3D live shows and you want tickets, then go to the BFI website. But remember, do it fast because they sell out pretty quickly. But the show happens every month, so there's always the next one. Keep watching the skies.